from the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts. Joe, can you hear me?
You broke up badly a moment ago, but I can hear you right now, Mike.
Okay, good, good. Well, I'm on the remote broadcast unit, and from time to time, it might experience some traffic here locally. But we're all set now, and it's a beautiful late spring day in Massachusetts, and it's quite warm today, brother.
It is. We've had a very cold spring. I think you brought the warm weather with you from Louisiana, Mike.
I dragged it up here, kicking and screaming. there's a couple of things that that Joe and I are going to talk about, some of the things that have that the Catholic Action League has been standing against here in Massachusetts. We'll get into those in just a minute. But like I told Joe in an email exchange that I had with him, we finally got into Brighton yesterday afternoon about 6:30 or so, threw our stuff into, or my stuff into the B&B here. And then my daughter, who lives over somewhere near Boston College and Boston University, we took a T train, got off the T train, went to her little apartment, dropped her stuff off, and then went down to a little diner down the street. I wish I could remember the name of it. But what struck me, and it always does, now this is my second trip in the last 6 months, Joe. What struck me about the guys that waited on me, the people that were at the door, and others that were around at the little diner and the restaurant and one of the other places that we went to, there is still here, as far away as Boston has fallen from being one of the crown jewels of Catholicism in North America, there is still an awful lot of Catholicity left here.
Oh, of course there is. It's just, Boston in the 1950s was probably about 72% Catholic by some statistics. And, of course, it produced some really great Catholic political leaders like Governor Edward J. King, U.S. House Speaker John W. McCormick, Congresswoman Louise Day Hicks, and, of course, Mayor and Governor and Congressman James Michael Curley. Now, of course, today you've seen, of course, the complete liberalization of the political culture and the liberalization of the Democratic Party, because it was the Democratic Party that was actually the socially conservative party, and it was the Republicans that were the socially liberal party. But there still is, of course, a great a Catholic tradition here. But I think what Boston is suffering from right now is a kind of colonization by New York, because you're seeing large numbers of people coming in from New York and New Jersey who are living here. And by some statistics, as much as one-third of the people in Boston have moved here in the last 5 years. So you could even notice in the Boston accent isn't as pronounced as it used to be. If you got the real New England accent, you'd probably have to go farther north into Maine. But there's still, of course, a really marvelous Catholic tradition. Boston was one of the first Catholic dioceses in the United States. It was in 1808, and it was Bishop Chevreuse, who later went on to become the Cardinal Archbishop of Bordeaux in France. It was William Henry Cardinal O'Connell was the first cardinal. It was certainly a great ecclesiastical tradition. You know, the first Catholic college in New England was in what was then the Diocese of Boston. That was Holy Cross, the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, and then, of course, Boston College came later. So you had a really tremendous Catholic presence here, and, of course, reinforced by so many Catholic immigrants, like my own grandparents, in the late 19th and the early 20th century. It's very heartbreaking to see, all the church closings and all the decline in the Catholic population, but there is still obviously among faithful Catholics, there is certainly a very, very strong Catholic identity and a very, very strong Catholic heritage. Unfortunately, that no longer New England. You know, used to be all. It was three New England states had Catholic majorities. Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts all had Catholic majorities. Now they are minorities in all three states, and even Rhode Island, I think, is only about 43% Catholic. So what you're really seeing is the secularization and the dechristianization and the laicization of the Northeast. While at the same time, you know, in the Southwest, you're seeing increases in the Catholic populations in places like Houston and other places. So it's a real demographic change in terms of American Catholicism.
You know, what's funny about that, Joe, is that my daughter, when we were stuck in traffic in New York, trying to leave New Jersey, get across the George Washington Bridge, and then into New York, we were stuck in traffic. When we crossed the New York state line into Connecticut, she actually started clapping. She goes, "I hate New York and I hate New Yorkers."
If you drive I-95 And just as you're leaving New York City, that there's a sign that says New England, and I always start humming, you know, Southie is my hometown. Whenever I go by that sign, it's a wonderful thing to be in New England. By the way, when you said you took a T train, you mean you took a streetcar, because Boston, like New Orleans, has a large streetcar system. So, but they're a little different looking from what they have in New Orleans. But Boston is one of the few cities that still has a traditional kind of legacy streetcar system.
Well, and now this is something else that we could talk about, because I was amazed about this. Now, she called it the train, and I said, when I got on it, I said, this isn't a train, this is a streetcar. She goes,
it's a trolley, it's a streetcar.
It's a trolley. Here's what I found amazing about it, Joe. In an age of robotic people standing online at McDonald's for 40 minutes just to get the same thing, while the burger place that's making fresh burgers across the street has no one in it, in an age of just total bigger is better, automation and mechanization is better, those guys, I stood up there right next to the guy that was driving the train. He actually has to drive that train.
Yeah, he does indeed, and it's a and if he talks on his cell phone, he'll be fired. He can't do that. It's very, very strict, and he's responsible with the bus drivers. It's strict with them, but it's even more so. My father worked for the MBTA, and his predecessor, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, and it's a it's $1 million worth of equipment and a couple of hundred people. So you have to have a good level of training. Boston had really the kind of the gold standard in American public transportation. The transit system for 50 years was called the Boston Elevated. Boston Elevated Railway Company, and then it became the Metropolitan Transit Authority. And remember, the Kingston Trio had a song about that, Charlie on the MTA. And then since 1964, it's been the MBTA. But it has an old legacy streetcar system. It has one of the first rapid transit systems in the country. It has America's first subway going back to 1897. And it even has a small electric trolley bus system, a trackless trolley system also, and, of course, a large bus system and a large commuter rail system. So it has Boston was in the forefront. What happened is in the 19th century, Boston had a lot of money, Mike, because of all the China trade and we know of also about the triangle trade and other things and other more illicit maritime endeavors. And they invested that money in railroads and in textiles, so that in the 1870s, Massachusetts had the densest railway network, both per capita and per square mile in the world, even more so than Britain. And they also invested it in street railways and in public transportation. So Boston became really, there was only four cities that had an original rapid transit system. That was New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and Chicago. And Boston was one of those four cities, and again, the first subway. And the first subaqueous underwater transit tunnel, the East Boston Tunnel, which went to East Boston in 1904. So it's had a marvelous public transportation system that was built up by our great mayor and governor, Catholic mayor and governor, James Michael Curley. And then in the 1960s, when Curley was dead, there was a lot of federal funding coming in. And then the Speaker of the House was John W. McCormick of South Boston, another great Catholic statesman. And he actually, Boston in the 1960s, believe it or not, not only got more money per capita, they got more actual dollars than New York did for transit, federal dollars for transit spending. So it's an advantage to have the Speaker of the House from Boston, you know? So we have a pretty good transit system. Anyways.
Well, what I was going to say, just as a final point about that, is so I was standing up near the front of the bus, and the first time I got on, $2.75 to ride the train, or the trolley, rather, which I had. Yeah. Second time, I got ready to put my money into the little my daughter has an MTA car, so she just puts her speed pass up there. I get ready to go start putting my money in there, and he goes, hey, man, don't worry. I have trouble with this thing. You're all good. You're fine. And I just kind of looked at him, and there was nobody behind me. So I said, "Well, thank you very much." He goes, it's nothing." And then he noticed the way that I was dressed, and he said, "So coming from church?" And I said, "No." I said, "Well, I went to church earlier today." And he said, "Well, you're not going to want to dress like that tomorrow." And he was telling me about the heat and all that. And I was watching him, Joe, as he was coming up on the stops. He has to manually ring the bell to let people know that he's coming. It's just, I was, you know, when you and I were kids, because we're about the same age, when you and I were kids, we loved playing with trains. So it was like being on a train, on a real train, and riding on a real train.
It's $1 million, you know, light rail vehicle, but you open the doors, you ring the bell. It's like people comment on the fact that even though it's a modern light rail system, it has all the resonances of a old-fashioned streetcar system. So it's like being on the streetcar. He opens the folding doors and he opens and he rings the bell and then rings the bell and starts again. So what happened years ago was they built these very broad boulevards in Boston. They put streetcar reservations on them. So in a lot of cities, the streetcars were entirely street running, and they lost them. But in Boston, we had the subway system, and again these large reservations on Commonwealth Avenue and Beacon Street and Huntington Avenue. So that helped to kind of preserve the streetcar system. And then in the 1950s, a very unusual thing happened. When everybody in the country was getting rid of streetcar systems, Edward Dana, who was the old Yankee that ran the Metropolitan Transit Authority, he basically put his thumb in the eye of the whole American transit industry and decided to build a new streetcar line. And what they did was they took over a former commuter railroad line of the Boston and Albany Railroad, the Highland Branch, and he turned it into a streetcar, high-speed streetcar line. And what happened is the ridership went from 1,800 as a commuter rail line to 22,000 as a streetcar line. So it was an enormous success. So it was almost all American cities, now there's a big revival of so-called light rail, but I think seven American cities, including New Orleans, abandoned their streetcar systems. Boston kept them, New Orleans, Philadelphia, I think Newark, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and San Francisco. We've been very fortunate here in Boston in terms of our public transportation heritage.
Well, just so you'll know, though, we do have the streetcar system back. It still works. It almost St. went Charles. Dormant. Yeah, it goes on St. Charles. It goes on Canal. It goes on Carondelet. It goes, and now it used to go all over, but not like it goes on Magazine. Not like it used to, but they put two lines back in. We're talking right now with C.J. Doyle, who is the president and founder of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts. Joe, let me talk to you about some Catholic stuff here for a moment.
Sure.
On Friday, May the 10th, the Catholic Action League was interviewed by Christian Wade, State House Bureau Chief of the North of Boston Media Group, on the decision of the Massachusetts Medical Society, and I guess this is the MMS, to oppose the right of parents to invoke sincerely held religious beliefs in seeking exemptions for their child, for their children from mandatory school vaccination programs. Now, as I understand this, and I actually was talking with my daughter last night, she goes, "Well, Dad, people that are anti-vaxxers are just nuts." I said, "You know, child, there is some medical evidence. Now, the propaganda inside the medical industry is pretty good on this to keep it going." I said, "But there's a growing body of medical evidence that there may be some links between some serious conditions that children are experiencing today and some vaccinations." So yeah. What's going on here with Massachusetts Medical Society?
Well, the Medical Society has decided they have an annual convention, and they had it at the Seaport World Trade Center in Boston earlier this month. And they decided, among other things, to try to promote legislation that will basically prohibit any kind of religious exemption to mandatory school vaccinations. That is to say, vaccinations that are required as a condition of attendance at a public school in Massachusetts. Now, as for the medical issues, I'm not a particularly expert at that, but there are some serious ethical concerns here, because I was surprised to learn this, but apparently many common vaccines, including those for measles and the mumps and chickenpox and rubella and others, apparently use fetal tissue from aborted children, which is appalling, of course. And Michigan Right to Life has done a bit of research on this, and I think they're referenced in the press statement that I put out. And there's also a group that Phil Lawler of Catholic World News is familiar with, called the Children of God for Life, which also deals with this issue. But apparently, they're harvesting in some of these vaccines, at least some of these very common vaccines, they're harvesting cells and tissue from aborted children, which of course means that Catholics that are using these could be it could be considered at least remote material cooperation with evil. Now, unfortunately, the National Catholic Bioethics Center and the hierarchy have seemed to take a more low-key approach on this, and seem to think that the good of vaccination outweighs the origin of the vaccine. But I think people who are sincerely pro-life Catholics, not only Catholics, but others. Orthodox Jews also, by the way, tend to be very, Hasidic Jews tend to be very opposed to this, are very, very concerned about how compromised the materials are that have been used in the production of these vaccines. And you're being injected with cells from a child that was butchered and then harvested. So, I mean, this is, again, an example of the pervasive abortion culture, the culture of death in our country, that you really can't escape abortion, even if you want to, because children are being used in stem cell research. They're being used now in the production of vaccines. Taxpayers, of course, are compelled to pay for abortions through Planned Parenthood and through individual states that have that provide funding. So it's just the tentacles of the abortion culture reaches into a broader society, and I think it's very, very appalling, and I think we should be very, very concerned about this, and I think the pro-life movement needs to address this issue, because are we encouraging the harvesting of children by utilizing these vaccines?
Well, you know, it's a point about this, just to make a little bit of a comparison. No one would argue that if you got a bunch of children that are Muslim as for their religion, and they're going to public schools, that you wouldn't. No one would say that it's a good thing, and that it's part of public policy that every Tuesday and Thursday at the school system, because it just happens to have a lot of swine farms in the area, has all pork day. You can get on the menu is bacon and pork chops or what have you. Someone would I think would propose a valid religious concern about that. No one that was sending their children to a public school. I don't think the Hasidic Jews do this, but if they did, say Wednesdays and Fridays, keeping with Catholic culture, right? Or seafood days, right?
Yeah.
Or shellfish days. I mean, this is a legitimate, even if you don't agree with any of the scientific research or the basis for the religious objection, it most certainly must be said that other religions outside of Christian, I use religions in air finger quotation marks, outside of Catholicism or Christianity, or one of the same, other religions have very explicit codes on what they can and cannot eat and what they will and will not eat.
Well, again, Hasidic Jews are very opposed to these vaccinations. But I mean, the American constitutional tradition, Mike, the American jurisprudential tradition, has always held that there should be a quote-unquote reasonable accommodation to persons' sincerely held religious beliefs. And of course, it is also held that freedom of religion is not just restricted to freedom of worship; it's the freedom to act in accordance with a religiously formed conscience. And in 1995, we had something called the Desolates case here in Massachusetts, whereby two Catholic brothers refused to rent an apartment to an unmarried couple, and their position was, even in liberal Massachusetts, their position was effectively upheld by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. And Justice Wilkins, who was then writing for the majority opinion, religiously inspired conduct is part of the free exercise of religion. So it isn't just, this is a Soviet definition of religious freedom. This is the one that Obama was pushing for a while, talking about, well, you have freedom of worship, but you can't discriminate. And of course, that's what's going on now, of course, where liberals would limit the freedom of religion to the freedom of worship on Sunday morning. They never really go after freedom of religion with a battering ram at the front door of the church on Sunday morning. What they try to do is they try to constrict the ethical and the medical and the charitable and the educational and the margins of religion, the outer parameters of religious speech and religious conduct. And that's really what's going on here. And by the way, speaking of which, we have another issue that has just come up that affects the whole country, and that was last Friday, the U.S. House of Representatives, under the leadership of Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California, passed H.R. 5, which was the so-called Equality Act, which would make sexual orientation and make gender identity part of existing U.S. civil rights law. And very ominously, it also specifically nullifies portions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 and prohibits appeals to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act for those seeking religious exemptions to civil rights laws. Now, if this passes, now I don't imagine it'll pass in the Senate, and President Trump has already indicated that he is opposed to this. But if this should become law, it will mean effectively the end of all Catholic adoption agencies in the United States and other Christian adoption agencies, because they would be forced to place children against their principles and against the wishes of the birth mother with homosexual couples. It would mean Catholic institutions, Catholic schools, and other institutions would be forced to hire those who are opposed to Catholic principles. It would mean that bakers and printers and photographers and florists and innkeepers and those in the hospitality industry and in the wedding planning industry, of course, would be forced to serve same-sex ceremonies. And it would mean that Catholic doctors and Christian doctors and Catholic hospitals could be sued or penalized for refusing to engage in gender reassignment surgery. We actually had a case recently where a man who considers himself a woman demanded that a Catholic hospital perform she wanted a Catholic hospital to perform a hysterectomy on her, and the ACLU is suing that Catholic hospital. So again, what we're seeing is this is the most radical, dangerous, anti-freedom, anti-religious freedom, anti-rights of conscience piece of legislation we've seen in perhaps in American history. And it would radically restrict and constrict the First Amendment guarantees to the free exercise of religion. It's opposed to religious liberty. It's opposed to the rights of conscience. It's opposed to freedom of speech. And Congress, the majority of the United States House of Representatives passed this. And by the way, here in Massachusetts, all 9 members of the House delegation of the Massachusetts congressional delegation voted for it, including all of the Catholics. And they all served, not only voted for it, but they served as co-sponsors. So here you have at least 6 Catholics in the Massachusetts congressional delegation, and all of them voted to essentially take away the religious freedom rights of Catholic individuals and Catholic institutions.
You know, Joe Doyle is the founder and the president of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts on the Dude Maker Hotline with me. Our telephone number, 844-527-8723. Brother Andre gave a stirring little interview with me 2 weeks ago on part of this subject, Joe. And Brother said that in the age of the faith and in the ages when, you know, we're told that the horrific and horrible and tyrannical divine right of kings was reigning, that in the age of Christendom on the continent in Europe, that men that lived in that age, if they would have been lawmakers of any kind, regardless of whether they were kings, dukes, barons, earls, what have you here, aristocrats of any kind, that they would have known. They would have known what it would happen a priori, I guess, if you will, that you wouldn't even propose. It wouldn't come out of the mouth of someone that was a Christian, or at that time, a Catholic that was living in any of those countries in Christendom. The two would never cross. The sacral would never cross the secular like that. It truly is a remarkable thing, and that I say that in a bad way. It truly is a remarkable and a demonstrable thing that not only does it cross the minds of alleged Catholics like Nancy Pelosi, and then if it gets to the Senate, to alleged Catholics like Senator Edwin Markey, that not only will they verbally support it, they'll actually put a vote. They'll go on the official record and will say yes to this. This is obscene.
Well, I mean, it was these people have no principles. I mean, their loyalty is to their paychecks and their pension and their per diems. If they have any principles, they're for sale, and the price is cheap. And by the way, if we were in charge, if conservatives were in charge, all of these politicians that we think are so far over on the left, they'd be applauding us and telling us what a wonderful thing it is that we support the right to life and the traditional morality and so on. They have no, I mean, they're simply political prostitutes, most of them. And they're careerists. And in the Democratic Party, they have a major donor base. They have an activist cadre. They have a primary voter base. And all of those are on the hysterical left. So all of these people, many of them baptized Catholics, are perfectly willing to sell out their own religion, sell out the faith of their baptism, betray whatever principles they had, betray their own ancestry and their heritage for the sake of their careers. You know, Hilary Belloc, the great Catholic historian, who was a member of the British Parliament, said that all representative assemblies are more or less corrupt, rather more than less. And Belloc would argue that monarchy was the, whether it was a hereditary monarchy or a presidential kind of government, monarchy, the rule of one man was always better than the rule of a representative assembly, because one man could actually act on behalf of the people, while the representative assembly will invariably act on behalf of the special interests. And I think we've seen that today. And of course, two of the most powerful special interests now in the Democratic Party, and also to some extent in the Republican Party, of course, are Planned Parenthood and the homosexual lobby. So this is what's driving the Democratic Party. And again, it's very sad that the Democratic Party was a socially conservative party, at least here in Massachusetts. Certainly it was the case where you grew up in the South, I believe, many years ago, Mike.
Wow.
But it's now become an hysterically, you know, it's really kind of morphed into a kind of Stalinist political party. All these reckless lies, these outrageous demands, these completely off-the-wall, you know, charges, this kind of calculated demonization of people, this incendiary rhetoric. This is something you'd expect from a kind of mid 20th century Eastern European Communist Party, not from the party of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. And as I'm a former Democratic Board Committee Secretary here in Boston, I'm a former Democratic City Committee member, a former Democratic State Convention delegate. It's just heartbreaking to see what's happened to the Democratic Party.
Well, it sold out to Beelzebub and the boys. Joe, final question for you before, because I know your time is valuable, but I got your press release a week or so ago. Tell me and tell the listeners about this rap video that was made, I believe it was at St. Peter's Church here in Worcester,
St. Peter's Church in Worcester, which is a very well-known church, very old, one of the oldest churches in Worcester. It's right on, I think it's a main street, right across from Clark University. And it's a beautiful old church, and the priests there apparently permitted the interior of this church to be used in an obscene, vile, blasphemous, sacrilegious rap video, in which the individual intersperses the F word with images of Our Lady and of the crucifix, and asks God why he hasn't killed President Donald Trump and such conservative commentators as Laura Ingraham and I think the other one is Tommy Lahren, also from Fox.
Tommy Lahren, right?
Lahren, and actually has a funeral easel in the sanctuary, next to the Paschal Campbell, in front of the altar, a funeral easel with a photograph of the President of the United States. And this is just absolutely outrageous. It's a vile, loathsome, obscene, blasphemous attack upon our Lord and upon Our Lady. And it's, you know, you're essentially calling for the death of the President. You're calling for the death of these other two individuals. And by the way, Laura Ingraham, you may know, is a convert to the Catholic faith and is well known as as an Orthodox and a pro-life Catholic. So here's a Catholic church being used to defame her and to call out for her death, basically. This fellow was asking, God, well, why did you take Malcolm X and others, you know, this extremist Malcolm, violent extremist Malcolm X, and left and not take Donald Trump and Tommy Lahren and Laura Ingraham? And the priest, of course, then pretended to be clueless and said that he knew nothing of rap music and didn't know what it was. So I presume he's been living in a submarine for the last 30 years. And they said that they made all sorts, and he tried to justify it, tried to rationalize it, that there was some quote-unquote positive elements in it. So, I mean, this to me, Mike, is just one more example of how kind of radically dysfunctional at every single level the modern post-conciliar church is. It isn't just, it's like a house where it isn't just the fact the roof leaks. The plumbing is broken, the electricity isn't working, it needs a paint job, the shutters are falling off, the plaster is cracking. Everything in the modern church seems to be dysfunctional. They can't seem to do anything right, and it's just appalling that it took a public controversy. Now the priest says he'd reconsider in the future letting the church be used for a rap video. It's just it's insane what's going on. I went to Mass there, you know, years ago. One time I was in Worcester on a Sunday, and the priest, it was a very large congregation from students from Clark University, and the priest gave a sermon on all the trials and travails he went through of buying a used car that week. So this is what passes for a homily, I guess, in St. Peter. So we wonder why the faith is dead among so many Catholics. It was we seem to have, I think, the faith is dead among Catholics because it died a long time ago among much of the Catholic clergy, who simply have conformed to the culture and surrendered to the spirit of the times.
Well, let me just say to you something that my dear friend, Father Dan Hesko at St. Catherine Labore in Middletown, New Jersey, I was invited to speak there about 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, 2 years ago this this month, two years ago on this rotation when I come through New England every mid-May, I went to St. Catherine Labore, and they were going to have my talk in the hall next door, but they were painting. And so Father said, well, I don't want Mike to have to go in there. There's fresh paint. There's the smell of turpentine. Somebody might pass out. She said, we can have it. We can have it in the sanctuary. And so when I got there, the first thing I did was I went to Father. And you know, of course, I said hello, and I kissed his hand. And I said, Father, because I saw that he had put the podium, a little portable podium up, like right in the middle, not on the altar, but just below the communion rail, but in the middle. And I said, Father, please tell me you took the Blessed Sacrament out of the tabernacle. He just looked at me like, Mike, what do you think? So I was like, because I wasn't going to turn my back to the Blessed Sacrament, much less talk about anything that could remotely, if I got a comma in the wrong place, Joe, I didn't want the Blessed Sacrament in there. So am I to understand that they left the Blessed Sacrament in the tabernacle, or do they not know?
Well, I really don't know whether they did or not, but you know, it was if they did, certainly it's appalling. But even if they removed the, the priest said he was away when this happened, when the filming took place. So he did not positively indicate that the Blessed Sacrament was removed, or there was anybody there to remove the Blessed Sacrament. So my working assumption is they left the Blessed Sacrament there. I don't want to be fair. It's just the whole thing is appalling. I mean, it was they allowed them inside the sanctuary to erect these funeral easels with photographs of the president. They filmed, as they said, images of Our Lady, images of the crucifix, and then interspersed those with vile, loathsome, obscene, impure language. And by the way, you know, rap music is pretty much defined by violence, celebration of violence, appeals to prurient interest, provocative language, obscenity, profanity, impurity. And then the pastor says, "Well, I don't know anything about it." My God! Well, I mean, if you don't know anything about it, shouldn't you find out about it before you let your church be used to film something like this? It's just it's appalling. I mean, it was it should be no surprise that so many people have lost their faith. When the clergy don't act like faithful Catholics, we see these polls where Catholics don't believe in the real presence. Well, I mean, who is informing them on this? You know, if the clergy act as though they don't believe in the real, if they don't genuflect, if they don't act reverentially, if they don't show by an example a respect for the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament, how do you expect that the people will? So again, I place a great—I don't want to be unfair, but I place a great burden on the conduct of our clergy over the last half century.
Yeah, I concur. All right, that's all the time we have. You can contact Joe. Joe likes to give his email address and his phone number out, but you can contact Joe at either one of the two. Joe, what's the best way for folks to get in contact?
Well, our email is CatholicActionLeague@gmail.com. That's CatholicActionLeague@gmail.com. Our website is www.CatholicActionLeague.org. And you can contact us by telephone at 617-524-6309. That's 617-524-6309. And we're always happy to welcome anyone's support or interest or comments and our membership is mostly in Massachusetts and New England, but we do have some membership outside of that. We have a few members in Ireland, so it was we're not bound strictly by the jurisdiction of the Commonwealth.
Well, it sounds good, and we're always happy to have you on, and blessed to have you on, and hopefully we will talk again very soon. He is Joe Doyle, the founder and the president of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts. If you got a story of something that's happening in Massachusetts that has anything to do with the Catholic Church or a Catholic politician or a Catholic misbehaving horribly in public to the detriment of the faith, you need to contact Joe and let him know about it. Brother, always a pleasure. I wish I would have got to see you on this trip, but God willing, for the both of us, I will see you in October at Brother Andre's.
Your time in Boston with your daughter, Mike. I'm sure it's a marvelous old city, and I hope you get a chance to do some some sightseeing. You know, the only Catholic cathedral in that was ever built by America's greatest architect, Charles Bullfinch, was built here. And sadly, the diocese tore it down in the middle of the 19th century. But we have a great, we have many famous old Catholic churches though here.
Well, we're going to head down to the Union Oyster House for dinner.
Good for you. It was bring a credit card. It's not cheap. Try the no name on the okay. pier. It's great food at about a third of the price.